Are you looking for new books to read? Do you like finding a new special author? Are you tired of the same old books from the same old authors? Well then, welcome to Discovered Wordsmiths, a podcast where you can hear from fantastic new authors. Join Stephen Schneider as he finds and talks to authors you may not know, but authors that have worked hard to write great new books. Hear about their book and why you should check it out. So sit back and listen to today's Discovered Wordsmith.
Hey, welcome to episode 87 of Discovered Wordsmiths. Now, before we get to the interview with Donna, let's hear a few words from Kindle Writing Life, one of my shout-out promos.
Hi, I'm Rachel.
And I'm Joni.
And we're from Kobo Writing Life, Kobo's free, fast, and easy self-publishing platform. KWL was built by authors for authors, and our team of dedicated book lovers is always working hard to help authors reach new readers around the world.
With Kobo Writing Life, authors can now publish audiobooks and ebooks right in their KWL account. We don't ask for exclusivity, and you'll always control your pricing in up to 16 currencies. You can also create a pre-order for your audiobooks or ebooks with no date limitations.
We have a lot of great opportunities for indie authors, including the option to include your books in our Kobo Plus subscription catalog in selected regions, as well as great promotional opportunities available in the Promotions tab right in your KWL dashboard.
If you're a KWL author and you don't yet have access to the Promotions tab or the Audiobook tab, email us at writinglife@kobo.com and we'll get you sorted. We're all about providing excellent support.
Create your free account today at kobo.com/writinglife. If you want to learn more about Kobo Writing Life, check out our blog, podcast, and find us on socials.
Okay, now let's get on to the interview with Donna. Donna has an interesting book that is about the 60s, surviving the 60s, which she did. And we had a really great talk about the time period and how things have changed. And it's important to have books like this that chronicle what really happened in various times. Things happening today will get some good books in the future by people who lived through it. This is kind of an autobiography, and she talks about why she wrote it and some of the interesting things. We had a good discussion about Kent State, which is very close to me. So, and I just want to apologize up front. We had some internet problems that day and it dropped a couple times. I've spliced things together, but it seems we're missing part of the interview, the second half. So all we've got is the first half talking about her wonderful book. I apologize for this. And we'll have to have Donna on again sometime and talk more author stuff. I hope you'll sit back and enjoy this episode with Donna. Here she is. So Donna, welcome to Discovered Wordsmiths. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well, except for a bit of a cold. So excuse me if I cough or my voice breaks.
Yeah, but the good news is you received it on vacation. So it's a trade-off, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, you can deal with a little cold to be able to get out in today's world.
Yes, it was wonderful to be able to travel again. I think a lot of people are feeling that, even writers who are isolated and tend to like it that way. I think most of my friends that are writers are anxious to start getting out and about.
Yep. I just went to a writer event in New Orleans. So that was a good time. Yeah.
That's someplace I want to go.
We'll have to talk. I'll give you a few hints. I mean, Anne Rice's house is down there. William Faulkner had a house down there. I visited those. So there's some good stuff.
So that's great.
Okay. So for everybody listening, tell us a little bit about you, where you live, what you like to do, things besides writing.
Things besides writing. Let's see. Well, I live in the Pacific Northwest, a small town, only 10,000 people, about an hour and a half southwest of Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
And what I like to do, I have a lot of different interests. One's I'm an avid reader. So whenever I have time away from writing, I tend to read. And I also really enjoy photography, and I enjoy teaching at writers' workshops. Does that count as writing? Nice.
No, that's great. What topics do you usually teach?
I teach a variety. One of my favorites is flash fiction, because my novels tend to be long tomes. I write historical fiction now. And so finishing a story in 20 minutes and then making some editing changes and doing it in under 1,000 words is just nirvana for me. So I like to teach other writers how to do that. So it's kind of instant gratification.
Yeah, that's cool. I like that. So you said you live in a small town, like 10,000 people. I still have you beat. We're like 2,200, but we have about 5,000 cows. So
there you go.
And what got you into writing? Why did you want to write, be a writer?
A part of it is in my book, House of the Moon, that I was raised in the 60s and got completely into kind of the hippie freak drug culture and was failing at school. And a high school English teacher just pulled me out of a nosedive. And I was driving stoned. Don't do that.
That's a result of the 60s right there.
And gave me a love of literature and of writing. And so I went to college to become a high school English teacher. Did that, didn't last too long at it. It was tough times back in the early 70s for teachers. But I never lost my love of literature. And in the early 90s, I finagled my way into being a journalist. And I was that for about 16 years.
Wow.
And doing interviews before podcasts, we had to go out physically or on the telephone.
Real interviews.
And with artists. And the more I interviewed artists and the creative process, I realized I wanted to do that myself. And so I picked writing back up and wrote my memoir, House of the Moon, Surviving the 60s, which tells a story of people that were marginalized and weren't listened to. And through that, I developed a love of telling other women's stories throughout history who were also marginalized and written out of history. And so one has led to another, to a 4-book deal, Magdalene Chronicles, which is going to come out in the first book in April. And hopefully that will go on and on and on.
So you write a little of both. You write some nonfiction and fiction.
Exactly.
And your nonfiction is kind of what I'm hearing more of, almost the new style, that where it's a fictionalized presentation of the nonfiction. Seems like that's very popular now instead of a very dry tone. Would you agree? Would you say that's what yours is?
Absolutely. Let's see. So it's not journalism. Mm-hmm. To me, memoir isn't journalism. It is a selected memory of a person. And so, of course, it's biased on the point of the writer because it's what we remember, which is why my book's written in vignettes. I say I remember the 60s in a little
time. I think that's pretty much universal, isn't it?
I think so. So to me, when you're writing memoir, this is also another class I teach called Writing Real, Writing Raw. And it is to be as honest, as open, and as dynamic as you can be. So people who are reading it will feel what you felt, will know what you were going through. And it's not just the facts. You know, it's not Dragnet, just the facts.
Right.
It is, here are the facts, and this is how it impacted me. This is how it made me feel, and this is how it impacted other people.
It is
more dramatic than journalism.
Tell us a little bit more about what your memoir covers, the vignettes and all of that. And then you mentioned a new series you're going to be working on. Tell us a little bit about that, too.
Okay. Well, House of the Moon, Surviving the 60s, is about just a 4-year period from the time I was 14 until just a little after 18 in the mid to late 60s. It goes from about 65 to 71. Actually, when I graduated high school. And I wanted to write it because people have a glamorized imagining of what the 60s were like. And, you know, we have a lot of social reforms and a lot of legal reforms because of what we fought for in the 60s. So the 60s was a very violent, turbulent, divisive time in history. If that sounds familiar.
Yeah, because we mentioned Kent State, because I live by Kent, and you said you got some in there in your book about
that. Yeah, Kent State was a sobering moment for people in the peace movement, because we knew people were being killed in Vietnam. We never thought people would be killed here, just peacefully protesting. So it was a real wake-up call, and it was one of the most dramatic things. Of course, the assassination of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy had the same impact as Kent State. But my book deals with it is a wild and crazy ride through what it was like to actually live in the 60s as just a kind of normal, average kid that got caught up in drugs, sex, and rock and roll. And the flip in the story is that my father was an undercover agent for the state of California with two teenage daughters in the 60s. And so that made for some tension and some unresolved issues. And on top of it, my sister, who was 4 years older than I was, her boyfriend dealt drugs to all the bands that came through LA. And when we're talking drugs, we're talking some pot, some, psychedelics, some drugs, some acid, some mushrooms and that type of stuff. So he wasn't, a hardcore drug dealer. No cartels involved. And it's my interaction with both these people, such as Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, Joni Mitchell, and how my life intersected with theirs, and then what it was like just to wake up in the trenches and be alive and be active in the 60s. So I feel it gives people an insider's look to what the 60s were like.
And you said you did some journalism. Do you think your journalism background helped you with writing the book, even if it was not so straight, here's the facts, that training, did that help you prepare for writing something like that?
Oh, absolutely. And I would say this for any writer. I mean, writing is an art and a craft. And until you tightly hone your craft, you don't have the liberty to express your art. And so in journalism, I mean, word count, the facts, making an interesting story just based on facts is the craft of writing. Being able to put a sentence together, being able to know a paragraph, starts with a lead and ends with a summary. And these types of things all go into the craft of writing. And that is whether you're writing a newspaper article or you're writing historical fiction or science fiction. You need to have your craft, and it's all the same.
Right. Okay. And I think it's interesting, too. I've interviewed two other ladies who have written memoirs that take place about the same time, growing up. One lady, they took a drive from Alaska down to Mexico in 65. Mm-hmm. Another lady was 60s growing up. So it seems like it's popular right now, that it's a big thing, memoirs from that time period. So I find it interesting that we're getting history, but not from our history books, but from the people who lived it. And I think that's exciting for youngsters.
Well, it is. And, reading any type of life stories from people who lived is dynamic, because we don't know it otherwise. And to me, I find history very dry, usually. Right. And so that's why I went into writing historical fiction, because you can put emotion and tension and human interaction outside of the historical facts.
Right.
To bring it to life.
Very much so. And we talked a little bit about that. I think there's a changing trend I've heard from people that memoirs are becoming more, like you said, dynamic, not fictionalized, but written in a fiction narrative more so, because that's more interesting to people. And it keeps them engaged.
And House of the Moon is written, actually, this was a conscious choice on my part. Dialogue isn't separated with quotation marks. And after the first page, everybody I've talked to, you get into it, and it is more a flow of consciousness. It puts you right there. Because when you and I are speaking right now, there are no quotes around what we're saying.
Right.
And I found with the memoir that putting a quote around what somebody said separated from the action and from the intensity of the moment.
You know, you just made a whole bunch of editors like get pains.
Cringe. And I will say my historical fiction is very classical in that quotes around everything.
You probably wouldn't have get an editor to touch it otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, getting sponsors and putting commercials in. Pause for this commercial break.
Exactly. So I did one. I don't know if you have seen Mind Dog.
No.
Podcast, and it was a fun program for like an hour and a half, but he has sponsors, and it's a very interesting show if you ever have time to watch podcast.
I'll have to go check it out. I know a lot of people listen to podcasts. They, even though it's on YouTube or something, they put the video on and then just listen to it. So all right, well, we talked a little bit about your historical fiction. Tell us what about those books, what they're called, and or you haven't even written, you met what they're going to be called and what's they're about.
Well, the first book is written. And it's called it's called The Last Magdalene. And the 4-book series is called The Magdalene Chronicles. And it is about the life and times of Miriam of Bethany, first century Judea. Mm-hmm. And she's come down in history known as Mary Magdalene.
Right.
And I am taking an approach of kind of demythifying the beginnings of Christianity, saying that these people lived and experienced their environment. They were under the occupational yoke of Rome, and it was a revolutionary time. And so I've gone back to original sources in Egyptian. The Egyptians had a lot of interchange with, especially Galilee, which we can appreciate going back to the 60s, that it says Galilee was the Berkeley of the first century.
Yeah,
where all revolutions came from.
They all wore flip-flops, didn't they?
They did wear flip-flops. Was that Chris Christopherson? Jesus was a Capricorn. He ate organic food.
Right.
Everybody, listen to Chris Christopherson. Jesus was a Capricorn. So it is... again, almost like my memoir, what was it like to be alive in first century Judea, to have your currency co-opted, to have a Roman patriarchal government come in and just slam down on all of your freedoms and all of your rights? And that there were, it culminated in 135 current era, or Kokhba Revolution, where finally we had the diaspora and everybody was out of Jerusalem. But it was ongoing probably from early in the first century before current era. And it was a series of people claiming to be in the line of King David and that they were the rightful king of Israel and Judea. And this comes down to us somewhat mythified or shrouded in religious context. But if you strip all of that away, you have real people living real lives and fighting for their very existence. And Miriam of Bethany is one of the primal characters in this whole drama that took place trying to free Israel and Judea from Rome. And so I'm telling her story through 4 books.
So it's historical fiction, meaning you've got the dates, times, places, people, battles, and whatever in there, but it's a fictionalized, so you don't know exactly what they said, what they may have done. Did you try and put in maybe a romance or kids going to school? I mean, how do you write historical fiction like that? And you mentioned it was similar to your memoir, which I thought was interesting. It's like the memoir of those people. So that's an interesting way of thinking about it. So just help me out. How did you write something like that?
Well, I took... first, I had a great interest in the fact that Mary Magdalene's mentioned so many times in the Bible, and women were usually discredited and left out. So she had to be somebody important. And so I started investigating the times and the places and what women's roles were in Judea. And I worked with a Hebraic scholar, Shannah Locks, out of Haifa University, to find what women's roles were in first century. And I found that women had incredible rights in Judea. And we were fed a line of, you know what, that women were not educated. They didn't have rights. They couldn't go in the temple. They were judges. They were what we'd consider rabbis. They were teachers. Women had incredible rights. They could inherit in their own name. One thing that is interesting is the Greeks had no concept of women being liberated, let's say. So when the word in Hebrew means a woman unto herself, the Greeks said, well, what could that possibly mean? Well, in Hebrew, it means a woman that didn't belong to a man. She was an independent woman. So the Greeks said, oh, well, that could only be a virgin. That has to deal with sex. No.
When it broke off, you were telling us about what you learned about free women in the Greek society.
Oh, well, actually, that women in Greek and Roman society weren't granted the same rights that they were in the Middle East area through the Great Sea, they called her, the Mediterranean basin. So both the Greek and the Roman societies were very patriarchal, and women belonged to men. And so when they translated the Hebrew word, which meant a free woman, it meant a woman unto herself, and they could not understand what that meant. So they said, oh, that means she couldn't have had sex with a man, so she's a virgin. And this was only one of the myriad of misinterpretations of words. Another one is the word Messiah, which did not have any religious connotations at all until the Middle Ages. It meant anointed one, which meant it was the anointed king. But the Greeks had this, but they translated it to Christos. And then it started gaining religious connotations once Christianity became the formalized religion of the Roman Empire. But it didn't have any mystical or religious overtones other than we experience all through, especially the Middle Ages, the divine right of kings, that they are chosen by God to be king. And so in Judea and Israel, if you were anointed with spikenard oil, then it meant you were chosen of God to be king. But it didn't mean you were God. I'll stop there.
Okay.
I've already got the editors on me.
So what other books that are out there would you say are similar to these books for people that may be interested?
You know, not too many. We have a lot of fanciful renditions about the Magdalene, everything from her being possessed by the evil goddess Ashara, and Jesus had to exorcise the demon goddess from her, to her being a Celtic slave woman that was taken to Judea, where she was reunited with Yeshua, who was also Celtic. And so we have all of this, but I don't know of books that have looked at the daily life and to say, this is probably what daily life was like. And the other big part of this book is that there's archaeological evidence that the goddess Ashara was still being worshipped by women, maybe clandestinely, but up through the Second Temple period, we find small statues of Ashara. And so my contention is that Miriam of Bethany was the priestess of Ashara. And it isn't all woo-woo or that. It was women need a loving, kind, life-giving, life-sustaining aspect of divinity to speak with and to entreat, to help with their daily lives. And this was present in all other religions throughout the Mediterranean basin, including the Greeks and Romans and Egyptians, of course. Everybody else had it. So to think that the Hebrews in the second period, temple period, didn't have it isn't logical. They did. They didn't like it. You know, the priest didn't like it, but it doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Right. So your book, the memoir, what was that called? I apologize.
House of the Moon, Surviving the 60s.
What made you want to write that book, the memoir, and then change and want to write this historical fiction book?
Well, it was kind of the opposite. I had started writing and researching for The Last Magdalene, and it happened very kind of surreptitiously at a Thanksgiving dinner where my brother-in-law said, did you really know Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison and all these people? And I said, yeah, I did. And he says, damn, why don't you write about that instead of people that have been dead for 2,000 years? And I went, huh, now that's an idea. So I wrote about my experiences. And I think in doing so, for all new writers, don't be afraid to change. Writing about myself and needing to be honest, needing to be graphic, needing to be accurate, helped in the historical fiction. And I see a connection between the two, as I started out with. Women in the 60s were marginalized. We had very few rights. My mother couldn't even get a driver's license unless my dad signed for it. That's being marginalized. I was denied a voice, which is why people of my generation fought for free speech. And this goes back throughout history, and I realize that we're all connected. That, you know, women today are still suffering a lot of the problems that Mary of Bethany was suffering in first century Judea. So let's give us a voice.
Nice. And let me ask that for a second, since you mentioned the musicians, and I like talking music. So all the people you used or you met, were they like everybody thinks they were, moody or high strung or anything like that? Were they pretty much the same that their public persona showed us?
Well, you see, in my interactions with it, I would have to say that Jimi Hendrix was one of the kindest, most big-hearted, loving, caring people that I've met. He was genuine, and he was about the music, and the music transported him and anybody that listened to it. But underneath that, he was a kind, generous person. And there's a whole chapter in the book about how basically he got me out of a really bad situation by just being a great guy.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, nice. For the other ones, Joni Mitchell is a phenomenal person, still is.
Nice, and good.
Also inclusive, not to the.
Thank you for listening to Discovered Wordsmiths. Come back next week and listen to another author discuss the road they've traveled, and maybe sometime in the near future, it might be you.